So today I start the last part of those lectures, which is going to be devoted to non-Abelian gauge series. So today I hope to explain how you define the classical non-Abelian gauge series and why it's interesting. Well, I'm not to discuss high energy physics, but just give an introduction. Tomorrow we are going to discuss the important issue of gauge fixing and quantization, and the last two lectures will be devoted to renormalization and I hope some more physical discussion, in particular, if time, the Higgs mechanism. Okay. So, well, you have already met a gauge series, of course, in these lectures, which is in QFT1, when you have discussed the quantization of quantum electrodynamics, namely the Maxwell theory coupled to fermions in canonical quantization scheme. So non-Abelian gauge series are an extension of U1 theory, of the Maxwell theory, which was first proposed, I think, in the 50s by Young and Mills. So the name associated with Young and Mills, which proposed that a gauge theory could be used as a model to describe the weak interaction, I think. So the interaction. So the idea was physically wrong, but mathematically very successful. It was based on an SU2 group symmetry, but it can be extended to any general symmetry group. And as everyone knows now, gauge theories are the basic ingredient to understand both the electroweak interaction and the strong interactions. So, and gauge theories, in fact, the full quantization scheme for non-Abelian gauge theories was worked out in the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, and this ended up in around 1972, I think, by the proof, or at least the first elemental proof of renormalization, of renormalizability, which was an important issue by Toft and Veltman. Man as an N, not two. Okay. Okay, so this is the history of the genesis of non-Abelian theories. Takes some time in physics, but this has become the pillar of modern high energy physics. Okay, so today we are going to treat the classical aspects, so the definition. Okay, so I'm going to assume that you remember what you did in QFT1 for Maxwell theory, which is based on the U1 group, and what you know from your previous year studies in mathematics, or what you did in the front-end course about the basics of group theory and Lie algebra. So I'm going to use my own notation, which might differ a little bit from the notes that you had, that I have here from the front-end lecture by Maite. I hope she's not here yet. And of the lecture notes by Tibra. I think that this is Tibra's writing. He writes very well. Okay. And so I'm assuming that you know what is a group theory, what is a loop algebra, what is a representation of a group theory. And I'm going to start on the example of SU2 group, because that's the simplest one, but to follow what's going on, you'll see how this can be generalized very easily. So the purpose of, you know, of the reason why gauge theories are important in physics is that, in fact, the interaction between quantum fields are mediated by currents. And that's already known in the case of the Maxwell and QED, because the interaction between fermions is a current-current interaction when you have two fermions, which is mediated by the electromagnetic field. Okay. And current-current interaction means that you have the carrier of the interaction, which allows to have long-range interaction, are spin one particles. You need to have spin one vector particle. So currents are associated with symmetry, spin one are vector particles, and for consistency conditions, they have to be massless. This is enforced both by the fact that you have a symmetry, and also by the fact that you have quantum consistency. And I will discuss, when we are going to discuss the propagator, if you have a massive vector fields, you are going to have inconsistency with unitarity and positivity. Okay, so. And of course, massless implies that at least in perturbation theory, you have long-range interaction. At least, let's say, classically. At least. OK. So before introducing what this non-Abelian gauge theory is for the SU2, let me just remember that one of the purposes is to couple it to matter. So I'm going just to introduce the notation for matter fields with a global symmetry, SU2 symmetry, just for the sake of notation. Okay, so I'm going to consider SU2, and I'm considering matter fields that lives in the fundamental representation because you may have theories where the matter fields lives in higher representation than the simplest sort, which is the fundamental representation. But as we shall see, the gauge fields always live in the adjoint representation, which is the second and quite natural representation. Okay. So I consider first a scalar field. Phi. But now it obeys a global SU2 symmetry, so it means that it has two components that we can denote phi1 and phi2. Okay, and each phi1 and phi2 is a complex field. Both are complex fields, which means that they are charged. It's like the Dirac field, okay? Scalar field, so spin zero, okay? And the fact that the theory has a global SU2 symmetry means that the theory, the action, is invariant when you change phi of x, so phi, of course, is a field, so it lives in some space, and phi of x is changed into g times phi of x, where g belongs to the SU2 group. So it's a 2x2 matrix. So it's a 2x2 matrix, so that g equal g dagger is g minus 1, and the determinant of g is 1. Means SU2. Okay. This is okay. So we denote the conjugate of the field by phi bar. So let us denote phi bar. This is just the phi, and I denote it as a raw file instead of column, but that's just for simplicity. So I denote this as phi or hi output. The indices in my note, the indices are, well, I don't think it's very important. So, well, okay, so this is phi 1 bar and phi 2 bar, and this is a complex conjugate. Okay. And of course, the transformation law is phi bar into phi bar times g minus 1, or g dagger. Okay. And we want an action which is invariant under SU2. So the invariant action is, it's easy to see that the invariant action is just to take as an action S of phi is dx. Well, let's consider that we are in four dimensions, but that's not very important. Of 1/2 d mu phi times d mu phi dagger, or rather d mu phi dagger times d mu phi, plus m squared over 2 phi bar times phi, plus g over, well, let's normalize by 8 here, phi dagger phi phi squared. Well, of course, phi bar by phi means that I get a scalar. So phi bar phi is just phi 1 star bar times phi 1 plus phi bar 2 phi 2. And the same for this. So this is a real field. This is a real quantity, real local quantity. Okay. Okay. And this interaction terms means that, for instance, the vertex of this interaction is something like that, where you have the index i g for this, which is the index of the group representation, are conserved. So this is the interaction vertex. Okay. So I, in this notation, I equal 1 or 2, is an index, we are going to call this a color index, which refers to the index of the component of the representation of SU2. Because the fundamental representation of SU2 is a dimension 2 representation. Okay. Index of the representation of SU2. And the fundamental dimension of the representation is 2. Okay? Dimension of the fundamental representation is 2. Okay. Okay. So now this action is invariant under this SU2 symmetry. So the symmetry implies that we have currents. Implies that we have some currents, which are conserved. Okay, and now for SU2, how many currents do we have? We know that the SU2 group is a Lie group, which has 3 generators. SU2 is a Lie group with three generators. Okay? Because we can write any element G of SU2. Well, at least if it's not too far away from the identity, as exponential of I times alpha. Okay? Where alpha is an antisymmetric matrix, and the alphas are typically of the form okay. So alpha belongs to the Lie algebra of SU2, and any element of the Lie algebra can be written as a combination of the three generators. So the three generators, they form a basis of the Lie algebra of SU2. And those generators generically for SU2 can be taken as TA equal 1/2 of sigma A. A goes from 1 to 3, where the sigma A's are the three Pauli matrices. So sigma X, sigma Y, and sigma Z. Okay? And which are, if you like, sigma X is 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma Y or sigma 2 is 0 minus I, I 0. And sigma Z is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So the generators of the Lie algebra are Hermitian matrices. So I alpha is anti-Hermitian. And this makes it this unitary. This unitary. This is an Hermitian matrix. Okay, alpha. So any alpha can be written as sum over A of alpha A T A. With alpha some real components. So the SU2 group is a Lie group which has real dimension 3. So has a manifold, it is a three-dimensional manifold. Okay. So this is the basis of the basics of okay, so what are the currents? If we use this notation, we expect to have three currents. Because we have three independent SU2 rotation transformation, and we can apply Vick's Noether theorem for any of these operations. So there are three currents, and the currents can be written. So we have currents that I'm going to write G mu A. Is A equal 1, 2, and 3. And if you apply Noether theorem to this action, that each G mu A is 1/2 of phi bar times T A d mu phi minus d mu phi bar times TA times phi. Okay? It's just the generalization of the formula for the electromagnetic current in U1 symmetry. Simply here, instead of having the Dirac field or a scalar charge field being a real number, a complex number, here this is a two vector. This is a 2x2 matrix, and this is a two vector, so this is a number. Yeah. Vector matrix vector. Okay. So we have three currents, and you can check that those currents are conserved. Okay. By the equation of motion of this theory. And these three currents, they can be grouped in a single object which belongs to the Lie algebra. So in the same way that you can weight any element of the algebra as an Herbitian matrix, alpha, you can group. So these are numbers, real currents. They are real because this is the emission conjugate of this one. So this is the imaginary part of this. So we can write an object that I'm going to call G mu, which is just the sum over A of G mu A T A. So remember, this is real. This is a 2x2 matrix. So this object that I'm calling G mu is a 2x2. 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix. So it's an element of the Lie algebra. It belongs to the Lie algebra of SU2. So G mu of X is an application from space the Lie algebra. So you can view this as a current living in the Lie algebra. Okay. So it's a mathematical notation, which is very convenient to group all these objects, those three currents in the Lie algebra. And with this notation, it's clear that this is, if you change of basis, and you make, or if you make a symmetric, global symmetric transformation, G mu acts, transform in the expected way. Okay. If you make a global transformation, global SU2 transformation on the field, G mu transforms according to the transformation acting on the Lie algebra. So in fact, this G mu, since it belongs to the Lie algebra, the fundamental representation, G mu transforms according to the adjoint representation, because the Lie algebra of a group is a representation of the group, which is called the adjoint representation. And that's very generic. Okay, so what is written here? Okay. So the fields phi lives in the fundamental representation, and the currents lives in the adjoint representation. And even if the fields were living in some higher dimensional representation, the currents will always be living in the adjoint representation because there are always only three currents. Okay. So this is a bit lengthy introduction is to make things clear. So remember, these are the currents. That's the most important part that we are going to need. And we need this for SU2. And of course, you can do the same thing for Dirac spinors. And let me just write briefly what this is. For SU2 spinors, now you have a Dirac field, which is a two-component field. You have psi bar, which is psi bar 1 and psi bar 2. So this is ordinary. Each of them is an ordinary Dirac field. The action is just d4x psi bar I d slash minus m psi. Simply now this is a vector. This is a vector in the SU2 representation. So each element is a Dirac spinor, so it lives in the representation, Lorentz representation of spinors. So it has four components, and we have two fields, which so we have eight fields. And the currents, here again, you have three currents, which are just psi bar gamma mu Ta psi. So now remember, this is a two-vector in the fundamental representation of SU2. This is a 2x2 matrix. This is a two-vector in the fundamental representation. So this goes to the scalar in the fundamental representation. And this is, in four dimensions, a four-component spinor. The gamma matrix is a 4x4 matrix. And this is four spinors. So this gives a scalar, a spin zero quantity for the representation of the Lorentz group. But here you have two representations. You have a representation of the Lorentz group and the representation of the SU2 group, but they are completely decoupled. They don't interact. Okay. And again, you can rewrite the current, which is the sum of G mu A T A, which lives in the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So now, how do we introduce gauge field? That should be vector fields. As been done for the Maxwell theory. Yes?
Sorry. So the size in the psi column, are those two-component spinners or two-four-component spinners?
Pardon?
Are those two-four-component spinners or two-two-component spinners?
No, they are two-four-component spinners, I think. These are usual, each psi is a usual Dirac, you know.
I see.
So in four dimensions, it's four. Okay. Four. Yes?
It's implicit that the gamma mu will act on the first spinor and the second spinor.
It acts exactly in the same way. So the representation. So the Lorentz. And the representation. It's a representation of Lorentz times the representation of SU2. So if you make a SU2 transformation, you mix the psi 1 and the psi 2, but you don't mix the component of the Dirac spinor. And if you make a Lorentz transformation, you mix the spinor component of psi 1. You mix in the same way the spinor component of psi 2, but you don't mix the spinor component of psi 1 with a spinor component of psi 2. Okay. Is that clear? So prefer each psi I equal 1 or 2 is just a psi I, some, okay, alpha, with alpha equal 1 to 4, alpha as a Dirac indices. So we have three indices implicitly in this, in what we are going to do. We have the I indices, which are the indices of the representation of the group. Maybe we should write this to remember. Okay, so I equal 1 to 2 indices for the representation. Okay, C2. A equal 1, 2, 3 are indices of the group indices. So they are indices that label the generator of the group. Hence, indices of the adjoint representation. And the alpha equal 1 up to 4 are Dirac indices. Okay, and of course mu equal 1 to 4 are Lorentz indices in the D mu. So I'm going to try to keep this this convention for indices. Okay, so gauge vector field. This is just, in fact, a generalization of what is done for the Maxwell theory. So you know, in the Maxwell theory, you can, of course, the physical field in the Maxwell theory are the electric and magnetic field. But the Maxwell theory is much easier to formulate it in terms of a vector potential. The vector potential is A mu of X. So it contains some redundant information even in the Maxwell theory because there is gauge invariance, but everything is better formulated when. Okay, so now instead of having one symmetry, which is the U1 symmetry, we have three symmetries that interact. So it's natural that now we have four. We have three vector potential. But they are going to interact in a non-trivial way. Okay? So we have three vector potential, which are real numbers. So this is a real vector. Each of them is a vector because it has four components, four Lorentz components, space-time component. And you have three of them. So each of them is a real vector. Okay. And as usual, we can regroup this in a A mu, which is A mu A times TA, which leaves, this is leaves in the adjoint representation of SU2. So this is a 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix, and each component is a space-time vector. Okay? And remember, the TAs are 1/2 of sigma A. So if you prefer, we can write it explicitly. This is A3 mu, A1 mu minus I A2 mu, A1 mu plus I A2 mu and minus A3 mu. Okay? This is A mu. So it's a 2x2 symmetric traceless matrix. Okay. And in addition, as in fact you can do in electromagnetism, mu is a vector, and the fact that it corresponds to gauge theory means that in fact it's a connection on space. So in fact, mu is an SU2 connection on spacetime. So this means that you can rewrite in an even more compact way all the four components of AMU as an object which is a form, a differential form. You have seen in front end a bit of geometry and the mathematics of manifolds and differential theory. So you can just write this as AMU dx mu. So this is a compact way to write this as a one form, which is in fact connection, which still is this 2x2 symmetric traceless matrix whose elements are real forms. And the fact that you can write A as AMU dx mu encodes how the AMU transforms under Lorentz transformation. So this just encodes how the AMU transforms under Lorentz transformation. Because this has to be invariant. This is an invariant notation. So when you make a Lorentz transformation, dx mu transforms the usual way. So AMU has transformed in the opposite way. Okay, so that's a compact notation that is useful to remember how the vector field transforms under Lorentz transformation. Okay. Which is a vector field transforms under Lorentz transformation. Okay. So we need this. So we need three potentials. We need this notation. And we're going to use this. Okay. But basically, the idea is very simple since we have a symmetry with three generators, so three different symmetries that mixes. We have three vectors. Fields instead of one. Okay? And of course, in the same way that we had here, now we have three currents, so it is those vector potentials that are going to mediate the interaction between the three currents of the matter field. That's the idea. Okay. So, now, of course, as so these are the vector fields. As in Maxwell's theory, the coupling between the matter and the vector field is going to be written in a simple way. The only way to have a consistent coupling between the matter, the currents, and the field is to replace the ordinary derivative by covariant derivative. So we are going to replace which is exactly as in the U1 Maxwell theory. Okay, so that's a mathematical trick, but that's justified by physics. Okay. So how do we define a covariant derivative? So we go from the ordinary derivative, which is d over dx mu acting on the field of the theory. And we replace them by covariant derivative that we write as usual as capital D mu, okay, which are going to contain, depend on the gauge field. And they are defined in the usual way. But the action of d mu on the field, the action on the field depends on the representation of the field. So it is going to be different from those matter fields, the scalar matter fields, or the Dirac fields that live in the fundamental representation. And it will be different from the action on a field living in the adjoint representation. OK. So the general definition is that if we have a field in a representation, let's call it R, with generators that I'm going to call TR, TA, that refers to the representation R, which are matrices, let's call it DR by DR, where DR is the dimension of the representation R. Okay. Then we have a field that I'm going to call phi r. It's a generic field that lives in the representation R. So it has now dr components. Components, okay. Then the definition of d mu, of the covariant derivative of d mu acting on the phi phi r, remember that it depends on x, is just the ordinary derivative, d mu of phi r of x. And then we had the usual term, which is proportional to a mu. So we get minus I a mu a of x times, well, it has to be a matrix because this is a number, TAR of matrix times phi R of x. So remember, this is a DR vector. This is DR by DR matrix. Okay. Each A mu A is a real field with just an A and a mu component. Okay, so we get the dr vector. So it still lives in the fundamental representation, in the representation dr. Okay. So this is a general definition. Of a covariant derivative. But of course, if you are still a bit uneasy about what is a general representation, we are going to write this explicitly for the two cases that are of interest for us at that stage, the fundamental representation, because that's the matter fields we have introduced, lives in the fundamental representation, and the adjoint representation, because the gauge field lives in the adjoint representation. So, application first. If R, the representation of R, is a fundamental representation of SU2, then of course we know that the generators are just the TA, which are proportional to the Pauli matrices. So what we have is that d mu of phi, if phi lives in the fundamental orientation, is d mu of phi minus I a mu a t a times phi, because the generators are just the t a are defined here. But remember, this is just what we called a mu. A mu being an object that gathers the three components of the gauge fields in a single object living in the adjoint representation. So we can rewrite this in a more compact way as d mu of phi minus I a mu times phi. Remember, this is a vector. This is a two vector. This is a 2x2 matrix. Okay. So this is the definition of the covariant derivative for a field living in the adjoint representation. So here I took the phi to be the scalar field, but you can replace the scalar field by the Dirac field. The formula the same. Okay. And now, so this is one. Two, if R is the adjoint representation, and remember, A mu belongs to the adjoint representation. So if I have a field that lives in the adjoint representation, let me call it phi R. Phi adjoint. So phi adjoint is a field which is whose component are a 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix. So it has three components. Okay. Phi A can be written as phi adjoint. What are the indices of the adjoint representation? A times TA, sum over the A's. Okay. Then, well, you can write out what are the matrix TA for the adjoint representation, which are 3x3 matrices. But this writes in an even more compact way because you know, one knows very well how the group acts on the adjoint representation. It acts just by commutators. So the final result is that d mu of phi, if phi lives in the adjoint representation, are just the ordinary derivative of the adjoint of a field living in the adjoint representation, minus I times the commutator of the field matrix A mu with phi adjoint. Remember, both objects are 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrices. So you may consider their commutator, and I times the commutator is still a symmetric traceless, an Hermitian traceless matrix. It's still an element of the adjoint representation. So this is a general law of transformation, which is very simple. Or fields living in the adjoint representation. Okay? Here we have commutators. Okay. And that's commutators because we have living in we are considering an SU2 group, but for a general group, this would become the Lie bracket acting on the Lie algebra. So this is the commutator are the Lie bracket. The Lie algebra. the coupe, which for SU2 or for SUN group or for orthonormal group, orthogonal group are the ordinary commutator, but for more complicated Lie group and Lie algebra are defined in an abstract way. Okay. Okay. So now and okay, so now it's easy that with this definition of what are covariant derivatives, what are gauge fields, what are matter fields, all those you know, those definitions are made in a completely generic way. So it's obvious that those objects satisfy the global SU2 symmetry. If you make a global SU2 transformation on the field, and if the, all the field transforms according to this action of the group on the representation, all those objects transform covariantly. Okay. Now, of course, since we want to construct a quantum theory which is consistent, we have to check whether, for this case, there is something analogous for SU2 to the local gauge transformation of Maxwell theory. So we have to go from global to local gauge transformation. So instead of making a global transformation like this, where G is the same at any point of space-time, we have to see what's happening on all these objects when if we make a transformation that depends on the point of it. Okay? So a global transformation means that for fields living in the fundamental representation, a local transformation, if we take a field living in the fundamental representation, let me call it phi f. This is going to be phi f because the phi f refers to fundamental representation. A local transformation means phi f of x is replaced by g of x, phi f of x, where now g of x is an element that depends on x. And if this is an infinitesimal gauge transformation, so that here g is exponential of I alpha, this is going to be g of x plus I alpha of x times, I'm sorry, phi of x times phi f of x, or an infinitesimal local gauge transformation. Okay, so if g is where g of x is 1 plus I times alpha of x. And remember, this is a 2-vector. This is a 2x2 matrix. So this is a 2-vector. Okay. And now, a field in the adjoint representation to transform not of g of x, but of g of x, the field, the adjoint representation of x, times g minus 1 of x. So this is the definition of the adjoint representation. And therefore, this is going to be, as you expect, Here, the multiplication by alpha will be replaced by the commutator of alpha. It's going to be, if you write this, phi adjoint of x minus I, the commutator. Oh, there is a typo. Alpha. No, that's okay. Of x times phi adjoint of x. Okay. Okay, so now there is a plus, I think, and not a minus. Okay. So now the question is exercise, if you like. How do the covariant derivative transform? Because the covariant derivative are basically, you know, a modification of the derivative so that the derivative transforms in a covariant way. While the ordinary derivative will involve some derivative of G, and so they will not transform in a covariant way. Well, you do the calculation, and you find that under under a gauge transformation, d mu of phi transforms as d mu of phi as expected. Well, it transforms in the covariant way. So, for instance, if you have a field in the adjoint representation, or in the fundamental representation, d mu of phi fundamental representation transforms into g of x at x transforms as g of x times d mu of phi f of x. So the potentially dangerous derivative with respect to g of x has been absorbed in the covariant derivative. Same way, if you have a field that belongs to phi adjoint of x, it transforms into g of x covariant derivative phi adjoint of x times g minus 1 of x. So it transforms covariantly. Okay. That's what they have been made for. Okay, but there is an exception for that, which is already exists in the which is that this is not true for the gauge field. Mu. Because mu lives in the adjoint representation, but in fact it's a connection. And that's something which is already occurs in the in the Maxwell theory. So, well, you do the calculation, and what you find is that A mu of x transform into g of x times A mu of x. Where is it? Plus I d mu g minus 1 of x. And this d mu is because the object which should transform covariantly is A mu of x d of x. So there is a new term. That just reflects the fact that A mu is a connection. And therefore, for an infinitesimal transformation, gauge transformation, what we are going to obtain is just this A mu of x transforms into A mu of x plus the covariant derivative of alpha of x, where alpha of x is the infinitesimal gauge transformation. It belongs to the adjoint representation. This belongs to the adjoint representation, so this is consistent. But here, we have the covariant derivative. Okay? Therefore, this is A mu of x plus the ordinary derivative of alpha of x minus I times the commutator of A mu of x with alpha of x. And, well, this makes sense. This is perfectly covariant. This is notation which is covariant in some sense. Okay, but of course, here you see a difference, which is with Maxwell theory, in the U1 Maxwell theory, there are no commutators because you have just one generator. So this is a real number. This is a real number. The commutator of two real numbers is zero. So in Maxwell theory, which is an abelian. This term is zero. And in Maxwell theory, you rewrite that a gauge transformation on the vector potential is A mu of x plus the ordinary derivative of alpha of x. In Maxwell theory, covariant derivative equals the ordinary derivative for the gauge field, not for the matter field. But that's only true for the Maxwell theory. So this result is natural, it's covariant, and it's more general. So we have not modified, in fact. This formula encompasses what's the Maxwell theory. Simply, this is the correct formula if you take into account the non-commutativity. Take into account the fact that SU2 is non-abelian. Okay. Okay, so now, okay, this was the math part. How to generalize the math of Maxwell theory by replacing an abelian group by a non-abelian group so that the theory of representation is much richer. You don't have just a fundamental representation, and the adjoint representation is trivial, by a general group of symmetry and how you can generalize the concept of covariant derivative to have a derivative that transforms according to the representation, how the gauge fields transforms, and everything. So now we have a covariant object, both for the fields and for the derivatives, under local gauge transformation. So now, of course, basically, we just have to, in order to build an action, so how do we build an action? Action. We just have to generalize what works for the U1 theory, namely define the field strength okay, namely the analog of electric and magnetic field for this theory, which contains three vector potentials instead of one. Well, that's easy, because simply in Maxwell's theory, the field strength is a symmetric Lorentz tensor, F mu nu, which is defined out of the derivative of the gauge field. But in fact, so in the Maxwell theory, this is just d mu a nu minus d nu a mu in Maxwell theory. But now, A belongs to the adjoint representation, so these are matrices. And we know that the gauge field transforms in a way that involves the covariant derivative instead of the ordinary derivative. So in fact, in order to define properly a field strength which has a correct transformation, you just have to replace this by the commutator of the covariant derivative. That's the covariant derivative defined in this way. So that's, in fact, that's analog to what has been done for the Maxwell. But then, of course, you don't get this, but you get an additional term, which is proportional to the commutator of the gauge field with itself. Remember, this is a 2x2 matrix. This is a 2x2 matrix, so the commutator is a 2x2 matrix. So this is a new term that comes from SU2, but it comes from the very definition of the covariant derivative, which is the same. So this is the same formula than in the Maxwell theory, but you get a different result because now the gauge field do not commute with itself. Okay, so this is the definition, and so F mu nu now is a 4x4 matrix. This is a 4x4 symmetric, if you want, Lorentz matrix, because its indexes are the Lorentz indices. And each element is an element of the adjoint representation. For each element, each F mu nu can be written as F mu nu equals sum over A of F mu nu A times T A, where A equals 1, 2, 3. So F. So each component of the stress energy tensor has, in fact, three components associated to the group indices, so associated to the currents. So in fact, instead of having one electric and one magnetic field, you have three electric fields and three magnetic fields. Okay? You have three electric fields in your theory. You have EA and BA. A equal 1, 2, 3. And that's expected because we have three different currents. So each current, so you have three different charges and you have three different currents, and therefore the charges create three different electric fields and the three currents create three different magnetic fields. Okay. And oh, F mu nu is not symmetric, I'm sorry, this is anti-symmetric, of course. This is a trivial error because it's a commutator. So it's okay. So, and as usual, the field strength can be written as a curvature tensor. So this is a curvature tensor. In the language of differential geometry, because the commutator of two derivatives. So you can write an object which is covariant, which is f mu nu dx mu wedge dx nu. So this means that it is a two form, but a two form that belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay, and this compact formula, you know, encompasses the way f. The component of F mu nu transforms under Lorentz transformation. So it's a curvature tensor that belongs in the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay, so this is the definition of F mu nu. Field strengths. And you can check that under gauge transformation, so under a local gauge transformation, F mu nu of x transform as expected. It belongs to the adjoint representation. So it transforms as g of x f mu nu of x times g minus 1 of x. So the covariant derivative again makes a job that the derivative of g, the dangerous derivative of x, disappears, cancels. Okay. So it's a it's well, it's a covariant object. Okay. So I think we are done. We have everything we need to construct an action which is invariant under local gauge transformation, namely, so it's invariant under the global gauge transformation, but in addition, it ensures the fact that the field, the gauge field, the vector fields, it stays massless, as in Maxwell's theory. And that's what we are going to do now. So let me keep this. This I can erase. So. So this was, I forgot, this was 4, this is 6, this was a 4. Fourth term, so this is my 7th blackboard. No. This is, there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so this is 5. 6, So now we are ready to write the Young Mills action, classical action, which is just a generalization of the Maxwell reaction for the Maxwell theory, the action that gives the Maxwell equations. Okay? So, the gauge field action, so let's call it Young-Mills. So it's a classical action which is associated to the gauge field A. And the gauge field A, here I denote it just capital A because I encompass all the indices, the Lorentz, and the group indices A. This is just integral over space-time. And here I'm going to consider the Euclidean space-time for simplicity, but which means that I can raise and lower indices mu, nu, Lorentz indices without any problem. But you can go back to the Minkowski space-time just by taking the East Coast metric. Okay, so basically this is just so the f mu nu of x. F mu nu of x of Maxwell theory is going to be replaced since now this belongs to the adjoint representation. So this is a 2x2 matrix. So this product is a 2x2 matrix. And you want an action which is a scalar, which transforms. So what you have to take is to take the trace of this. Simply because if I take the trace of the product of two matrices, it's a scalar. And well, taking into account the fact that this is antisymmetric, you have to get a minus and you normalize. In order to have a positive action, you have to normalize. And I'm going to introduce a coupling constant here, which is going to be the coupling constant. Constant. And we'll show why we have to introduce this. Usually in Maxwell theory, you don't have this term because simply this is quadratic in AMU, so any normalization can be absorbed in a normalization of AMU. Here, F mu nu is a product of two, so it contains a term which is here f mu nu contains a linear and a quadratic term. So changing the normalization of A changes the normalization of this coefficient. Okay. This means that I keep the normalization of A mu so that the transformation law has this simple form. Okay. And, okay, so what is this action? So you can check that this action is indeed gauge invariant. It's obvious, because if you make a global gauge transformation, you replace trace of G f mu nu mu nu by trace of g times f mu nu times g minus 1 times g times f mu nu times g minus 1. And by this vanishes. And by cyclicity of the trace, this term vanishes. So this is just this. So the action is, this is automatic. Okay. So that's it. This is the generalization of the Maxwell action for the electromagnetic field to an action which is automatically gauge invariant for this non-abelian gauge field. Okay. So now, of course, this action contains, for classical theory, the classical theory is in fact very different from Maxwell theory. It's very different because the definition of F mu nu now contains this non-trivial term, which is non-linear. So the action is different. The action is non-linear in A mu. The vector potential, which means that there are interactions between the gauge field and that's to be expected because in U1 theory A mu doesn't carry any group index, which means that the photon is neutral. In U1, A mu, carries no group index, because there is only one group index, which is trivial. Which implies that the photon is neutral. Here, if we go to SU2, the MUE carries group indices. So they transform under the symmetry. The gauge fields are charged. They carry charges, and therefore they interact. So even the theory with no matter field is a highly non-trivial interacting field theory. And already at the classical level, it has a lot of non-trivial properties, and it is still studied by physicists and mathematicians as in its sound, finding classical solution of this gauge series is a difficult task. But some solutions, some classical solutions are very, very interesting. Okay. Okay, so now let's see what are those interactions. Which interaction? Well, you can study the interaction by just using perturbation theory, you assume that your gauge field is close to a field where there are no electric field and no magnetic field, because in any case, the minimum of the Young-Mills action is obtained by A mu equals zero up to gauge transformation. Because in any case, F mu nu equals zero. If F mu nu equals zero, the action is zero. And A mu nu equals zero can be easily achieved by setting all the gauge fields equal zero. So you can expand in powers of A mu to have an idea of the interaction. And if you want to write the Lagrangian density, this term, the Lagrangian density, which is just trace of F squared, Oh, bref. Well, this is a notation which is a bit misleading. Because if I write f, I have to consider that f is a curvature tensor, and f squared would mean something which could be different. Okay. Anyway, so the density, you can expand it in terms of f mu nu, and let's write it precisely in component. So exercise in components. Remember, A mu is A mu A T A. So in fact, you have the three fields, T A, and use the fact that T A T B in the adjoint representation of SU2, the TAs are just the Pauli matrices. The commutation relation of the Pauli matrices are known. They involve just the completely antisymmetric Levi-Civita tensor. So use the fact that TA, TB, and I just have to find the notation because otherwise. Well, TA is 1/2, so this is 1/4 of sigma A, sigma B, and the sigma A, sigma B are epsilon A, B, C, if I'm not mistaken. But there is a 2, so it's something like that. Up to a factor that's proportional to epsilon A, B, C. And if you write this and go back to this, you get that the Lagrangian density for SU2 is, first you get the usual on A bar. No, I'm sorry. That's A mu. A mu. Okay. Okay, this is the Maxwell term. Simply now you have three independent gauge fields. But then, because of the commutator, you get additional term, epsilon A, B, C, D mu, A nu, A times minus D nu, A mu, A, times A mu, B, times A mu, nu, C. You have a term here that comes from this commutator times this, and then you have a term that comes by the product of the two commutators. So you get minus 1/4 of A mu A of X, A mu B of X times A mu A of X times A mu B of X minus A mu A of X, A nu. Yeah. A nu B of X times A mu B of X, A nu A of X. So those terms, this term is different from this one because you have changed AB into BA here. Okay, so you have the Maxwell term here, you see? So this is, right? This is the Maxwell term. And these are the new interaction terms. And you have one term which involves three gauge fields and another term which involves four gauge fields. And, well, I'm almost done. We are going to discuss the rule of perturbation theory and gauge fixing later on, but you can get that a Maxwell term which means that in perturbation theory the gauge field degrees of freedom transforms like propagates like photons, so you have a propagator which is going to behave like photons, but simply you have three different photons. But you see, here in the Maxwell theorem, the mu1 doesn't couple to nu1, so the charge is conserved. Okay. But the new terms, coming from the fact that we are dealing with a non-Abelian theory, means that we have interaction terms that involves three gauge fields, three photons, and this interaction involves change in colors, change in charges. And since here there is an epsilon ABC for SU2, it means that you have one photons which charge one may transmute into a pair of photons which charge two and three. Okay, and in addition, you have these terms, which means that you have a four photons interaction. Okay. And you see in this term that you have one A, one B, one A of B. So it means that here, in some sense, a pair of photons with same charge may transmute into a pair of photons with different charge. Okay. And finally, the fact that in order you have a 1 over g square here, you can, you know, reabsorb the g in the normalization of A, so that this contains no g, but then this contains a g, and this contains a g squared. So this interaction term is proportional to the Kuplik constant g. This coefficient is proportional to constant g squared, which means that G is, in fact, the charge, the gauge bosons, is proportional to G. We can view this parameter as a charge of the gauge bosons. Okay. And then, well, let me give you still 2 minutes. Add matters. If we had matters as in Maxwell, you just replace the d mu by covariant derivative, which means that you are going to have, for instance, an interaction between the fermions and the gauge field. But now, the gauge field carries a group index, A, rule 1, 2, 3. Fermions for Dirac fields. The Dirac fields belong to the adjoint representation, so they carry an index I that goes from 1 to 2. G goes from 1 to 2. And since the gauge fields now are charged, the interaction involves a change in the charge of the Dirac fields. And the interaction is also proportional to G. So there are not so complicated but non-trivial relation between the interaction of the gauge fields, the interaction of the matter field, and the relation between the charge of the matter field and the charge of the gauge field is not arbitrary. All charges of R G times some group rational coefficient. So if the gauge field has charge 1, the Dirac, the fermion fields cannot be arbitrary. And the relation between the charges of the different sectors of the series is given by the, is fixed by the nature of the symmetry group. Okay, so thank you. That's what I hand up here. I'm already a bit late. And tomorrow, starting from this action with all this formalism, we are going to start to discuss how this theory can be quantized using path integral formulation. Because path integral formulation for non-abelian gauge theory is much more simple than canonical quantization.